Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of True Crime on Easy Street. I'm Katie Givens. I'm not a lawyer.
Scott Wright, mediocre journalist.
Kelly Turner, not a doctor.
And we're back for part two in our series of our Dark Parks series.
This is Ghost Train Fire part two.
Yes. And on that note, speaking of amusement parks, Scott.
Yeah.
You were mm-hmm. what they call a cast member.
That's right. I was a cast member.
At Disney World.
Yes.
In Orlando.
That's right. At the Magic Kingdom, Adventureland.
Tell us about it.
I was a skipper on the Jungle Cruise.
And what does the skipper on the Jungle Cruise do?
He acts like an idiot. So it was the perfect job for me.
How old were you when you had this job?
I was 21.
How long were you there?
21.
Yeah, I turned 21 while I was there, and I got the first time I ever ordered a drink legally in a bar. I was alone at a TGI Fridays because all of my roommates worked that day.
Oh, no.
And I ordered a chocolate monkey.
Oh.
Which is, it was delicious.
Was it?
It was chocolate and banana. It was a frozen drink. I didn't know what else to get. I wanted to do something that I would remember, and obviously I did because 33 years later, I still remember the drink that I ordered.
It sounds fantastic.
It was good, but I was by
myself. How did you get this job? How did this come about?
I was in the, I was a student at Alabama at the time, and I was in the Ferguson Center, which is the student union building.
And this is the University of Alabama.
In Tuscaloosa.
Okay.
And there was a note on the wall that said, interview for a summer internship this was going to be the spring. I was there from January until May of 1991. And I thought, you know what? I'll go in and see what this is all about. And got called back for another interview and they offered me the job. And you don't know what you're going to do until you get down there. You're going to take a semester off from school. You're going to drive down to Orlando and you're going to live in this massive complex with 2,500 other college students from all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to be an employee, not an employee.
You're a cast member
at Disney World.
At Disney World. And you have no idea if you're going down there to scrub toilets.
That's or right.
Like literally you have no idea.
My roommates all ended up working in the kitchens at the various places.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I made enough of an impression.
I'm going to guarantee that you interviewed well.
Yeah. So that, I mean, I got to be, I was the cool dude in my dorm because I worked at the Jungle Cruise.
You can talk to anybody.
Yeah.
You can, there's
and I
no,
guess that came through.
You're very high energy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So you stand in the front of this boat. Mm-hmm. It's one of those boats like from the Humphrey Bogart movie, The African Queen.
Mm-hmm.
I forget what they're called. And it's hard to explain. But you don't control the boat. The boat is on a predetermined course. All you control is the throttle.
Right.
You can speed up or slow down or go backwards.
Oh, or go backwards.
And there's a big ship's wheel in the front. And, you know, it was always a gag to spin it in the opposite direction. If we were going to turn left, I would always spin it to the right and just to see if anybody noticed.
Mm-hmm. Did anybody ever notice?
Oh, sure. All the time. And after you did it for a while, it like anything else, it turned into a job. So we would start to do, the other guys and I who worked at the Jungle Cruise, we would do different accents sometimes.
What was one accent that you did?
I used to do my Australian accent, which is terrible. I mean,
Let's hear it.
I can't even do it anymore. Put another shrimp on the barbie.
Oh.
You know, it's bad.
And I'm sure people notice.
Oh, that, sure.
Yeah.
And then I would change halfway through. I'd get tired of doing it and go back to the way I spoke.
Oh, great.
But it was a goof. It was a fun. It was a lark. Mm-hmm. It was a blast.
But that's what you
And I'm
expect.
Still in touch with some of those people today.
What a great experience. Yeah.
In fact, it was my friend Laura Wildman, who told us after we did two of these episodes, she listened to all of them from the very beginning. She said, I know who you are. Tell me who the other two people are. And that's where we came up with the introductions that we still use today.
Awesome.
That's my friend Laura.
What a great experience. Does Disney still do this?
Yeah.
Like if you are at a college, pay attention or Google.
It's
now.
Called the
Disney College Program.
College Program.
I think the DCP, I knew people in college who.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So
it was a blast.
What a wonderful experience and meet some interesting people.
I had one brush with celebrity while I was there.
Who?
Paula Abdul.
Wow.
So when you're a skipper on the Jungle Cruise, you take turns. You take two laps around the lagoon,
mm-hmm.
and they're 10 minutes apiece.
Okay.
So you do the boat twice, And then you move to the load position where you let people into the boat for 20 minutes. And then you move to unload where you get people out of the boat when they come back from the ride. And then you have a 20 minute break.
Oh, okay. All right.
So you work an hour, you get a 20 minute break.
Okay.
So I was in the unload area. And that's where if somebody was handicapped or had special needs or
sure,
that's where you let them in. Or I found out that day, that's where celebrities got to skip the line and go in. But I didn't know who this person was. She was wearing, I still remember what she was wearing. She's wearing a navy blue blouse with white polka dots, white pants, like capri pants.
Not really.
A big straw hat and sunglasses. And I didn't know who she was. And I held her by the arm and helped her get into the boat. And then the phone rang at the shift supervisor stayed. I forget exactly what his title was. The lead. We were cast members. The lead is the floor manager.
Sure.
And the phone rang and he said, hey, be on the lookout. Paula Abdul is in the area. She's coming to the ride. And I said, yeah, I think I just put her on the boat.
So did you take her on your Jungle
Cruise? No,
just helped her.
I helped her get in.
So that's her.
And didn't even know who it was.
That's funny.
It's probably a good thing I didn't, or I might have kissed her right on the mouth because I had a huge crush on Paula Abdul at the time.
Wow. Was she nice?
Oh, yeah. She didn't say anything. I mean, she was there with, there were two other people with her. There were three of them. And when you let somebody in, when the boat is empty, they go to the front of the boat, and that's the cool place to sit when you...
Sure.
When you take the ride.
Awesome.
Did they ride alone or were they with
people? No, no. You pulled down to the load area and then the boat filled up with everyone else.
But they were in the front.
But she was protected by those two people sitting to her right. So, and she had her head turned towards the front of the boat. Nobody knew it was her.
Nobody even, especially with the big hat and sunglasses, I'm sure. Okay. So did you ever meet any people on the boat that you didn't like?
I don't remember having any bad experiences.
It was awesome.
The fun part was, and all of the guys, we all tried to have one good ride a day. And by that, I mean, everybody laughed at the stupid jokes. I mean, the spiel was horrible, just corny and silly. But if you had one boatload of people in a day where everybody laughed and just really had a good time, you had a good day at work.
It's like your audience was responding to you.
Yeah.
Is the way it works. It's a thing.
Yes.
It's why if you've ever done any kind of, like when Shane goes somewhere, he's done, you know, cons arts and things, you know, here and
hundreds.
Go to plays and all that. And when he goes somewhere, he's a very good audience participant.
Yeah.
And I think you learn that when you have done that, even if it's on a small community theater level kind of thing,
you feel this.
That and you understand that and you respond to it. Yeah. So that's fantastic. I had some, well, the Graves went years ago, Jake and Julie and their kids, and had a great time at Disney. And I remember Julie coming back and telling me, Kelly, there was something down there that was made for you. You should be.
Oh yeah. What was it?
You should. She was like, you should be, on one of these rides, the girl who was doing, it was one of the underwater, under the sea, I guess, kind of thing.
Yeah, the
she's like,
the submarine.
You should totally be doing that. Or the evil stepmother that goes around and like verbally abuses everybody.
Oh, yeah.
I was like, I think I'd rather do that. But she said one girl, her whole shtick was she was grumpy and that was kind of like her character. And
I gotcha.
And she kind of did this and they... thought it was hilarious and had a great time, but how fun would it be to, I mean, I could do that now at my age. Cause they get age appropriate for some of these. I could totally be the evil stepmother.
There were several people, there's 50 skippers on the job at any one time because people are on break, unloading, loading, and you're milling about waiting for your shift to start. There were guys there who had been there for 20 years and that was their full-time job.
How much fun.
Yeah.
And you enjoyed working for the company.
Yeah. I mean, I was ready to leave when it was over.
Well, yeah, because it was a temporary thing.
Yeah. But it was, I wouldn't trade anything in the world for that experience.
Right. Did you ever get to see the underground?
Oh yeah. That's how we got there.
The whole town.
Yeah. When you parked in the parking area, you entered the, and we call them the tunnels, but it's really just the first floor of Disney World. You can't dig in Central Florida, you're going to hit water.
Right.
So the first floor is the tunnels. That's the access ways and the piping and the garbage gets collected and so that you don't see any of that in the park. That's one thing that Disney wasn't able to do at Disneyland in Anaheim when he built it in the 50s. And so when he built when they designed Disney World, mm-hmm. he wanted to make sure that you were completely, you'd forgotten about the outside world.
And that's also where
this illusion of
the characters
magic.
Can then become themselves again. Like the ones mm-hmm. who are dressed up for pictures, Mickey Mouse can take his hat off.
Sure.
His head off.
I saw Mickey walking around with his head under his arm, you know.
But
all
that's
the
on
time.
The first floor.
Yeah. Nobody goes
always
down
on the
yeah,
first floor.
Yeah. You do
floor.
That in the park and you're fired immediately.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. You can't, yeah.
Can't
you
take can't do the that. Head off of mm. Mickey.
And you can't speak.
And you don't say words. Mm. And I have learned that it doesn't matter how many people are in that line. When it's time for break, they're breaking.
Oh, yeah.
They don't mm-hmm. play with that. Mm-hmm. We'll be back in 15.
Yeah.
You know, and you're just kind of stuck there. If you've mm-hmm. got a kid who you're like, come on, do we really need to stand here and wait? And it's
and the
always
is yes.
Always.
Yeah, the
always
is yes.
We do. We're going to wait. So what a fantastic, Scott, I know you were great at it. I know you were.
Had a good time. Mm-hmm. I really did. And it gave me they just kind of threw you out there mm-hmm. and I didn't know what I was going to do. And they just said, hey, you know what? You're a skipper on the Jungle Cruise. Go down tomorrow and get your costume.
What was your costume?
It was like a straw hat and then a safari type shirt with big breast pockets on the front. And you wore tan shorts, and then you just wore no. You could wear shorts. I always wore pants. Mm. And then you wore black shoes, and you supplied your own shoes.
Okay, mm. All right.
So, fun. Well, I guess I wore shorts. I mean, I got there in January, so I wore pants until it got warm enough to wear shorts. And I think they determined, hey, everybody's wearing shorts today.
So yeah, it was not optional.
No, I don't think so.
Today's
so
shorts gave you day.
You had two uniforms, really, or two costumes.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. or two
yeah.
costume pants.
And, you know, you had your own locker, and you know, just and you could. There was a room as big as this one, just full of straw hats. You could just go in and get any kind of straw hat you wanted.
Did you always introduce yourself as Scott, or did you change up your name to have fun?
If you lost your name tag, and everybody wears a name tag, even the guy, Eisner, was in charge of Disney at the time, Michael Eisner, if he came into the park property, he wore a name tag with a little picture of Mickey at the top, and it just said Mike. Everybody at Disney wears a name tag.
Okay.
So if you lost your name tag or you just wanted to goof around, there's this big basket full of name tags. Mm-hmm. And so that was kind of a gag. We'd all go in and get three or four name tags. And, you know, one day I would be Miguel or Jacques or whatever. You know, you could. It was just something to mix it up a little bit.
Fun.
Yeah, we had a great time.
That's awesome. All right, so here we are. We've had our nice little mm-hmm. opener here.
Yeah, Shane loves it when we do the long banter at the beginning.
Oh, so we should mention some things, right? Shorty's Shrimp Bowl.
Yeah, that's going to be this Saturday as you listen on July the 3rd. Mm-hmm. That is the Wednesday, I think, mm-hmm. that you are listening at right now.
Whatever day.
So that's on Saturday at 3 o'clock, $14.99. You get shrimp, sausage, mm-hmm. potatoes, corn, whatever else.
And Shorty.
And
time
Shorty.
With Shorty.
You get some time with our good buddy Shorty West.
Good time. It is definitely worth it.
And Carter Penholster will be the live entertainment. Yes. All the games will be yep. kicking on the time. Patio area mm-hmm. at Easy Street. So come and hang out with us and celebrate the 4th of July with some really, really good food.
Happy Independence Day
yes.
with Shorty.
With Shorty. one shout out, Melissa Washburn.
Okay.
Is a Center City employee. Stephanie West reached out to us via text message a few days ago and said, hey, talk to Melissa. She's a big fan of the show. She said, you guys should do the Bertha Hill story. Mm-hmm. And it took us a minute to remember that we did that season one.
Season one. It might
episode
be.
Episode 30.
Yeah, it might be an opportunity for us to try to revisit that one.
If that may be another one that we want to put on the list. We mentioned one last week, the Yellow Creek story.
Yep. Yeah.
So maybe we could add the Bertha Hill. And you could, if you go back and listen to something that we did that long ago, mm-hmm. the show's probably a lot different then.
I think it has a different feel.
Than it does. Yeah, I think mm-hmm. so. And I mean, we were still learning.
Yeah.
We hadn't settled into this exact format yet.
Sure.
We were playing around with things. And I don't remember how we did that one. I think, did you do that one?
I did Bertha
Hill? So, mm-hmm. And that was a Rome, Georgia story.
There was a time when most of the stories that I did were women who poisoned everybody. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So it was kind of weird.
Like we did have a run on poisoners.
Weird, weird thing there. Okay. So are we ready?
Yeah. I think
to get
so.
Back into this, you left us on a terrible cliffhanger.
Yeah, I did.
I'm still upset about it. But nonetheless, here we are.
Here we are. Back and for part two of the ghost train fire.
Let me see if I can recap
Do it.
What I remember from last week. And,
okay.
and you guys can tell me if if I'm remembering this correctly.
Oh, we'll let you know.
Where we left off, there was a ghost train ride that seven unfortunate individuals went into and never came out alive.
Yeah.
Three of them were from the same family.
That's right, a dad and two boys.
A father and two young sons. Mm-hmm. And then four were four middle schoolers who went to what they call a college.
Yeah, Waverly College.
Waverly College.
It's like a preparatory middle school, I suppose.
Students.
Yeah.
And they had all of these individuals had survivors who were there that day.
That's right.
The mother.
There was a fifth little boy who got out of the ride.
Mm-hmm.
And the mother of
the two children and wife to the husband. Right. So they're standing there. They see this go
up in flames,
totally helpless.
Yep.
The son is back home. He's witnessing the parents
melting,
trying to deal with this or falling apart. The wife goes home to the dog. You said that's it.
And an empty house.
The very next day, everything's cleared and it's an electrical fire and no one's questioning who is this detective?
Detective Inspector Douglas Knight.
Douglas Knight. But what you sort of teased last time was that Douglas is probably not on the up and up.
He's going to come up again today.
Okay. All right. So did I miss anything important moving forward?
I was going to do this. I'm going to go ahead and tell you, I think I mentioned the name of the documentary last week.
It's called Exposed,
The Ghost Train Fire.
Yes.
So if you want to know a lot more about this story, there are chunks of this story that were the 101 version.
Sure.
So we're leaving out chunks of this story, but you'll get a full dose.
Okay.
If you watch that 3-part series, each one of those is about an hour and a half long. So you're in for 3.5 hours.
Okay.
4.5 hours total.
All right. Got it. All right. Let's do this.
But check that out. So the documentary is made by this by the Australian Broadcasting Company, ABC. It's kind of like our NPR or C-SPAN or like the BBC in Great Britain. It's their national broadcasting. Very well done documentary series. So the funerals for many of the seven victims were held on the same day on June the 15th, 1979. That's 6 days after the fire at Luna Park. The four boys from Waverly College were buried in a service at a Catholic church in Sydney. They all attended the school together. As we mentioned, they were all 13 years old.
Mm-hmm.
The fifth boy who was with them in the car behind, we mentioned him last week, Ron Holman. He was the one who ended up standing outside and watching the fire with Jenny Godson all together.
Who is the mother and
she
wife?
She was the mother.
Okay.
Yeah. So finally, a couple of weeks after the fire, the police officially reach out to the parents to tell them, hey, the investigation has turned up no evidence of anything nefarious. It was an electrical fire. Sorry.
What are you investigating?
That's a great question, because we already know that they cleaned off the scene of the crime
by
the next afternoon. There was no investigation.
What are you looking into?
There was no investigation.
You're interviewing the park owner or the... Because there was also no water in the hydrants there at the park.
Yeah. Yeah, that's another oops.
Is that an oops?
That's worse than an oops.
Okay.
Yeah, much worse. So that scene, as we've mentioned, it wasn't taped off with police tape.
Right.
Nobody was scouring through to figure out where the fire started or if any accelerants had been used. It was just over. They put out the fire that night around midnight. Finally, at 2 a.m., six of the bodies were removed from the scene. At 3:30, a crane arrived to begin cleaning up. At 5:40 p.m., the seventh and final body was removed. And by 3 that day, any evidence of anything was completely gone.
Mm.
Who could authorize that? Who is this person who can say, clean it up?
And the bodies are identifiable. I'm sure that their loved ones have
dental records.
Dental records is all.
Yeah, that's it.
That's terrible.
So we mentioned already Detective Inspector Douglas Knight. That's the man we talked about last week.
I'm guessing he's authorized all of this.
Who may not be one of the good guys. Yeah, he was in charge of that scene. it was he who authorized it.
He is making haste.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't like it.
Yeah. That very afternoon, he got in front of a television camera from a local news crew and looked it right in the face and said, it's an electrical fault, no big deal.
We're done
And that
here.
Led to the stories in the papers
mm-hmm.
that afternoon. The official police version of the story included statements from four anonymous witnesses
okay.
who said that they saw a fire on the roof of the building before anywhere else.
Okay.
Now, as I mentioned last week, there's a portion of the ride was a portion of the ride where it looped outside behind this mm-hmm. caged in area. And so everybody in the midway could see your car come out and go right back in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That might be where you would stand if you're going to watch your loved ones ride it.
Sure.
You know, how some people don't want to ride, but they want to watch their loved ones mm-hmm. and kind of get a wave or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So at one point, about 10:15 that night after the fire had started, the cars, as we mentioned last week again, started coming out into that loop.
Empty.
Empty and on fire.
Oh.
And then you'd go back in, make one more turn, and you would enter the unload area mm-hmm. of the attraction.
Mm. So were there people on these cars that made it out?
Yes.
Okay.
There's only seven who passed. I mean, not only seven, but
yeah.
of the... You said
there were about 35 people okay. in the ride when it happened. 11 wow. cars with three people. And some of them, there are witnesses in that documentary who will say, I was in the ride and all of a sudden I saw fire leap out of the wall.
Leap out of the wall.
Well, not leap, just suddenly appear.
Mm-hmm. Here it is.
There's a little bit of fire, and then there's two or three more. And then they would go around and come back to another area of the ride, the other side of that same wall,
mm-hmm.
and saw the wall completely engulfed in flames on that side.
Oh, no.
So it had burned through that wall, and they
and
saw
was
it.
Making its way.
Yes.
Okay.
And there are people who were on the ride when it happened who describe in this documentary the ever... growing presence of flames as the ride progressed.
And I'm sure it's smoke and heat.
And some of them got out and ran and made it. That's why.
Got out.
Mm-hmm. Most of them got out.
Mm-hmm.
Because when the 12-year-old was going in, who was in a car behind the mm-hmm. four 13-year-olds, someone yelled fire and he was yanked out.
The ride operator
out.
Yanked him out of the car. Mm-hmm. But the car kept going.
Right? Yeah.
And you asked about that last week. So for whatever reason, once it started, it's got to come around.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why you
see
them in
flames. Because they sort of make
that,
at Disney, they have those that kind of keep going and they give this illusion that, oh, I got to go, I got to get mm-hmm. in, I got to jump.
Yeah.
But if they ever need to stop it, they can in
sure.
one
yeah.
push of a button mm-hmm. to let someone on who can't make it on that quick.
I mean, remember, this is a pretty primitive ride. It was built in 1935, basically hadn't changed in 44 years.
And we're in 1979. So totally different world yeah. than where we are today. Sure.
So the place where the people who were on the ride first saw flames was not on the roof, as the police report indicated from these four anonymous witnesses.
Okay.
It was in the area where the fake fireplace was located.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's just a coincidence, but there was one lady who tells in the documentary, she said, you know, I'd been on this ride before, and I know that's supposed to be a silly looking fake flame. That looks like real flames. I'm going to reach out and see if it's hot. And it was hot.
And she was like, oh no.
That's where the fire started. That's where people first saw fire, was around this area.
In the fake fireplace.
Of the fake fireplace. And it's in a corner in the middle of the building.
This would be even scarier today because we have these pyrotechnics.
Mm-hmm.
So people mm-hmm. probably yeah. would just assume this is part of the ride.
Wow, exactly. That's really realistic.
Yeah, yeah, and that's what another person yeah. says this, exactly that, Katie. He said, you know, it was where the fireplace was, so I just assumed that it was part of the attraction.
They got fancy. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they mm-hmm. got fancy this year. Exactly.
Mm.
So the cars were empty that came out in the loop because the people who had been in them saw the fire, smelled the smoke, and got out of the damn thing and tried to get out of the building.
Fight or flight.
Yes.
And they chose to fly. Yeah, get out.
And then right in that area, the fire, when you do the loop and go outside and go back into another set of swinging doors, that's where the fireplace is, the fake fireplace.
Mm-hmm.
And so the doors open and anybody standing outside can look in briefly, and that's where people outside the ride saw flames.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't long after that, there was an explosion.
Boom.
A huge fireball crawled out of those doors. into that caged area, up onto the ceiling. I mean, just, it was, one lady like said it looked like an atomic blast.
Kind of like a whoosh.
It was a whoosh.
Comes out.
Yeah.
Because like, that air.
Maybe the air fed the fire and that was just at the right moment and backdraft whammo.
Oh. Mm.
And like I said last week again, there were photos taken by tourists who were outside looking at the ghost train.
And there's no fire on the roof.
There's no fire on the roof. The fire's coming out of these doors.
It makes you wonder who these four anonymous people were.
It certainly does.
Because everybody else is pretty okay with giving their name and who they are and saying, this is what I saw. Yeah. But why these four anonymous people didn't want to give their names, that's strange.
So we know it's not an electrical fire.
Okay.
We're pretty certain about that.
All right. And we don't think it's the whatever's going on, the fan to make the little flames dance. No. We don't think that caught on fire.
I don't think so.
Okay. All right.
And like we said, the ride, the cars kept going and it was operated by electricity on this electric track. So there was electricity still feeding this ride.
And you were telling me last week that if it had been, that would have shut down.
Immediately.
Okay.
It would have shorted and everything, the electricity, like when your power goes out at home, bam.
I mean, it's gone.
It just stops.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a photo of the scene the next day after the ride has been cleaned up and removed almost completely. And you can see this in this one photo, the fuse box.
Mm.
Still there, still intact. It's one of the only intact pieces of the entire ride.
No
burn marks, nothing.
Yeah. Wow.
So again, no electrical fire.
Okay. I'm still interested to know what these firemen are saying who have arrived. They're not saying anything.
They're putting out the fire.
They just put it out. And
they didn't have time. The fire marshal comes in and figures out where the fire started, but he didn't in this case because it was gone. It was cleaned up.
So they said, we just put it out. We're not even talking about anything else.
Yeah.
Because, you know,
it's
nowadays,
not the fire department's job.
The detective, if I'm the detective, I'm going to want to talk to the fire marshal and say, what are your thoughts on this? What did your guys see? Can you tell me where this started or how this might have happened?
If you wanted to find out what happened.
Sure.
If you didn't already know what happened.
Well, also
or you wanted
true,
to pretend you didn't already know what happened. Mm-hmm. Sure. Mm-hmm. If you want it to look like an investigation, that's what you do.
Mm-hmm.
On that note, a few weeks after the fire, there was an official inquest that was held to try and determine, and this was the coroner, because the coroner has to determine the cause of death to put it on the death certificate.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the police department that's involved, it's the coroner's office that is involved.
Yes.
They interviewed 80 witnesses over 3 weeks. None of the witnesses saw a fire on the roof.
Now, this is the coroner doing this.
That's right.
Okay. 80 people say, no, I did not see a fire on the roof.
That's right.
Okay. All right.
But at the same time, any reference of the fire inside the building didn't get asked about. It was almost like they didn't want to know either.
Mm.
Somebody's, the fix is in.
Okay.
It's starting to seem.
Okay. I'm willing to jump on the fix is in boat.
Yeah.
But what is our motive?
I'm getting
Am I
there.
Jumping ahead?
I'm getting
okay,
there.
Sorry. Sorry.
It's okay.
Yeah, because I mean, what?
I don't see
what,
it either.
Yeah.
What is the, again, what's the
when
motive?
I tell you,
okay, all right.
You're going to have that same look of clarity come over your face that I saw in all of those people in that documentary when it hit them.
When it hit
oh,
them.
Oh, shit, that's what this is all about.
Okay, all right. Well,
you're going to have that same moment of
when am I going to get to that?
In a couple of minutes.
Okay, all right.
So ultimately, the coroner's inquest did not find sufficient evidence of negligence to charge anyone. They just said they died of
accident.
Death by flames.
It was an
smoke
accident,
inhalation and their bodies were incinerated.
Yeah. Okay.
The coroner even said in his report, maybe somebody tossed out a cigarette. We don't know what happened.
Because in 79, I'm sure you could absolutely ride on this ride while smoking.
Sure.
You could fly in airplanes and smoke cigarettes.
Yeah.
I still get in planes today and they have the little ashtrays.
Yeah, if it's an old 737 or whatever, it's still got the ashtray and the armrest.
On it.
Yeah.
Have you ever flown on one of those?
I haven't. You could smoke in
a hospital in 1979.
Absolutely.
The doctor that saw you at the hospital was probably smoking.
When he gave you your cancer diagnosis. It was a different world.
Yeah.
So,
hey, hold my cigarette. Well, yeah, I got to go get a pen.
The world could have burst into flames at any moment because of the smoking.
Yeah.
Smoking was prescribed for pregnancy weight gain. Here, smoke this. It will keep you from gaining too much weight while you're pregnant. It's a different world.
I cannot. I've been watching, well, I just finished watching Peaky Blinders, and that's all they do is smoke cigarettes.
Yeah, that's, have you seen it all?
Mm-hmm.
I've got one season to go. You know, there's a movie coming out.
I've heard.
Yeah. Okay. Cillian Murphy is just amazing. I used to not like him as an actor, and I don't know why.
Why?
Because I love him as an actor now. I don't know.
It's just a different world. So
yeah. So in the documentary, there's this one police prosecutor that they interview. He's speaking about this inquest for the very first time in public, all of these years later. The documentary is 3 years old, so it came out in 21. So what, 42 years later?
Okay.
Old man now. These guys were young, and they show pictures of them when they were in their prime doing these jobs. He said, it looks like the police, quote, put the blocks on everything. Evidence didn't see the light of day.
I don't even know where evidence would be.
Right.
He also said there is not one scrap of evidence to support that the fire was caused by electrical fault. And he said he was frustrated by the fact that the police hadn't looked into the fire deeply enough.
Okay.
He makes all these statements in the documentary.
Sure.
Did I mention, and I know that I didn't, that's why I asked that. Did I mention that more than one of the witnesses who were not called at the coronal inquest, for whatever reason, I'm about to tell you why, they were put on the witness list, but they never called them. They smelled kerosene burning when they went through the ride. Some of these people were the ones who got out and ran, and they smelled kerosene burning.
That's a distinct smell.
This one guy said that he knew the smell very well because when he was a kid, his grandmother used a kerosene burning heater in the wintertime. So he knew exactly what burning kerosene smelled like.
Sure. We grew up here with those and with kerosene lamps.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Sure.
Absolutely.
A very distinctive smell.
Yes. Yeah, my grandmother always had kerosene lamps for when the power went out.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. And so before you ask, no, there was no kerosene used at the ghost train ride for any purpose.
Wouldn't think so because the fire was lights.
There's no storage area where kerosene was kept. There's no, there should be no smell of kerosene on the ghost train ride.
Okay.
There's no need for it.
Unless you want to burn it to the ground. There was another witness that speaks for the very first time in the documentary in public, who was standing outside the ride about 10 minutes before the fire began, before the first person yelled fire. And there was this group of bikers.
Motorcyclists,
yes. And they call them, it's odd in the documentary series to pick up on the quirks of language. They call bikers bikies.
Okay, so they mean motorcycle riders.
Yes.
Okay.
And we know guys who ride motorcycles. There used to be a motorcycle group in town that did a bunch of great things in the community. So I don't want to put a...
No, we love them here.
Yes.
Yeah.
But these were ruffians. They were described the dirty t-shirts and denim vests and long hair and earrings. And not that there's anything wrong with that, but you throw them all together and you get a suspicious looking character.
These folks were typically up to no good, is what you're saying. In this area.
Yes.
Gotcha. Okay.
One of the witnesses says in the documentary that he heard them talking about kerosene and matches in the minutes before the fire broke out.
Kerosene and matches.
I'm going to skip some of the details from the documentary here, but at this point, you've got to go watch
it. Oh, no, I'm definitely watching it.
So they interviewed this guy on camera. He said, now, this guy was, at the time, he was 14 or 15 years old, and he lived in a halfway house. He was a foster child.
Okay.
So he'd been into a little bit of trouble in his life, nothing major, but when he told this story to the police the next day, they didn't believe him. And then they convinced him that he needed to change his story, mm-hmm. or he might get himself into some trouble.
Yikes.
Yeah. So he did. He was a kid. He just changed it.
He was. Mm-hmm. He
said, no, I just made it up.
Yeah.
But he saw, he overheard, he said, I was standing 2 feet away and I heard this guy say, I just went in and poured kerosene and threw a match in it. And another guy said, that was stupid. We need to get out of here. And they took off running. Well, that's the story that he tells.
Wow.
I'm sorry. So the theory is that when this kid's story worked its way up the chain of command at the local police station, mm-hmm. that's when somebody went back and got him, hauled him back in and said, you didn't see that.
You didn't hear that, nor no, did you see
not,
that.
That didn't happen, or you're going to be in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
So he changed his story.
And I would too, if I were that age. Mm-hmm. And, well, gosh, I'm 45. I don't know what I'd do if mm-hmm. I've got law enforcement in front of me saying,
breathing down your neck.
You better change your story or you're in trouble.
There was a second witness who heard the same thing and told the same thing, and they didn't believe her either. She was 14, and they just waved it off.
Just whatever.
We know that didn't happen, so stop telling that story.
Mm-hmm. And but is she friends with the other person?
They were together.
They were together, and yeah. they heard the same thing.
That's right.
So you have four ears mm-hmm. who
yeah,
are,
that's right.
heard that. Okay.
There's another witness who tells his story for the first time in the documentary in public. He was one of the ride operators that night.
Okay.
And he was busy loading and unloading the guests out of the ride. But at all of a sudden, down at the end of the ride out front, he saw a door swing open and three or four bikers come out of the door.
Mm-hmm.
Like they had gotten into an employees only mm-hmm. section and gone into the ghost train. And he saw them coming out the door.
Oh.
10 minutes before the fire started.
Again, motive.
I'm getting there.
Okay. I mean, what? Why do bikers care about a dark ride?
Maybe somebody paid them to do it. Yeah.
Why does somebody care enough about a dark ride to pay somebody to do anything yeah. like this? I am so
maybe it's
confused.
Maybe it's because the property where Luna Park is located is right there on Sydney Harbor in one of the most majestic, beautiful places in the world, and it's an amusement park when it could be a high-rise condominium or a 500-room hotel.
No.
Yeah. Now there comes the clarity, but there's more to it than that. Okay. So a total of 7 witnesses told police at the time. I said these guys are speaking publicly for the first time in this documentary. They had been telling this story privately for years. 7 witnesses saw the bikies
mm-hmm.
milling about the ghost train in the minutes before the fire started. The police ignored them all. All the talk of kerosene and matches and the coming out of the door.
Mm-hmm.
Ignored by the police. So we've got more than one crooked cop at this point.
Definitely. Got to have more than, mm-hmm. than that for this to work.
And so now we get to the part of the story where we're going to start using the words, interjecting the words that we mentioned when we closed last week and left you cliff hung. Cover up, conspiracy, arson, and murder. But why? I've already given you a little bit of a hint. What's the end? What's the angle? We'll get to the bottom of it right after these words from our sponsors.
Hey guys, do you know what time it is?
Tell us.
It's time to plan your best vacation ever right here in beautiful Cherokee County, Alabama.
Many outdoor adventures await. You can wet a hook in beautiful Weiss Lake, swing away at Cherokee Pines Golf Club, climb to the best year-round at Cherokee Rock Village, hike the Little River Canyon National Preserve, take a days-long splash at Pirates Bay Water Park, and there's so much more.
The Cherokee County Chamber of Commerce and Tourism has a full list of recommended lodging facilities, RV sites, and campgrounds, and they're all set up to suit your vacation needs, whatever they may be.
So come see us from wherever you are located. And if you already live right here in Cherokee County, then plan your summer staycation with the Chamber by visiting cherokee-chamber.org.
Guys, we want to let you know that don't forget that Easy Street is now open for lunch 5 days a week, Tuesday through Saturday,
yeah,
open at 11.
Great lunch menu.
Mm, let's do lunch.
Brand new. We've shared it on our Facebook page, and I know that Shane has also shared it on the Easy Street Facebook page, so it's mm-hmm. easy to find the menu, and it's terrific. Everything on it.
Yes. What's your favorite thing, Scott?
I like the hamburger steak with the mashed potatoes. The mashed potatoes are better than I can make. And I make pretty darn good mashed potatoes.
No, they are.
They're terrific.
Mm-hmm.
Katie, so what's your favorite?
Yeah.
I like, well, you can get a flatbread pizza. Mm-hmm. I also like just the chicken fingers.
Yeah, chicken fingers mm-hmm. are great. Best chicken fingers in town. How about mm-hmm. you, Kelly?
I like the rice bowl with the chicken and the
yeah.
vegetables.
It's all
the
good.
Yum yum sauce.
Ooh.
So delicious. You're not going to go wrong. Salad bar's always fresh.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Have lunch at Easy Street. You might see us there one day.
Yeah, you never know. 11 to 2 every day is when the menu prices on the lunch menu are.
That sounds right.
That's right. Something like that. Everything that comes out of that swinging door is delicious at Easy Street, we promise.
Yes. Thank you to Easy Street for being our primary sponsor, our main sponsor.
Yeah. Thanks, Shane. Go eat lunch.
Yes.
Yes.
Come see us.
Would you like to be a sponsor of True Crime on Easy Street? If the answer is yes, we have a very simple process.
I feel like I've heard it before, but tell me again.
Okay. So you send us an email. Our email address is truecrimeoneasystreet@gmail.com. All lowercase, all one word. We don't need any uppercase letters. We're not fancy.
Why are you telling me that? I know how email works.
Well, I'm just being cautious.
And you know, it's pretty cheap too. It's only $30 a month if you'd like to be a sponsor. And we've only got a couple of slots. We don't want to inundate our listeners with ads. So we just have a couple of slots available. Come and hang out with us every Wednesday here at True Crime on Easy Street.
Correct. So send us an email and we'll give you the opportunity to customize your ad. We won't sit up here and just blab on if you don't want us to.
Like
or
we're
we
doing
might.
Now.
We might. I mean, it depends on what you want.
Exactly.
The customer is always right. So send us an email. We'll get back with you very quickly and we can get you set up for the low price of $30 a month. And that's cheaper than any radio ad, any newspaper ad.
Yeah. We have about what, 300 listeners every week on this show. Is
we
that the right number?
We have more than that.
Is it more than that
yeah,
now?
Yeah. So
see, the last time I heard it was only 300.
You can expand your audience.
Like using, we've expanded ours.
Yeah, using our platform. So give us an email at truecrimeoneasystreet@gmail.com. Thank you to all of our sponsors. Scott, come. I mean, I've got. Let's do this.
Let's bring it home.
What the heck?
All right. So the name of the man that you are going to need to know for the rest of this story.
I need to know.
His name is Abe Saffron.
I don't like that name.
Okay.
I don't like him already.
Okay. Yeah.
He's going to figure prominently in the third of those of that 3-part miniseries.
Okay.
On Netflix.
Abe Saffron.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, honest Abe.
Yeah. Now. Yeah.
Right.
Dishonest Abe in this case.
Saffron, right. Like the spice.
Yeah, I guess so. S A F F R O N. I think so.
Okay.
Now before we get into Abe Saffron, there's a couple of other names that we need to resort just to get everything
okay.
headed in the right direction. And here we go with the mob again.
Uh-oh.
The Genovese crime family in New York City had connections to Abe Saffron. And it's a lot more complicated than that, a lot more complicated that we're not going to go into that. We're the 101 version, like we always say.
All right.
Watch the documentary.
Yeah, just go. Here we go. The Genovese crime family.
But we've given you the X that marks the spot.
Sure. Okay. They are connected to Abe.
Yes. Now let's go back to Detective Inspector Doug Knight for just a minute. He was described years later by someone in this documentary as a cop who was a fixer.
Okay.
If you wanted something cleaned up and done away with, Doug Knight was the guy you put on the job because he was a crook.
Okay.
A crooked cop.
All right. Way to go, Doug.
So according to this ABC documentary, Australian ABC, it was Doug Knight who made sure the ghost train fire was cleaned up and gone the next afternoon. It was Doug Knight who ordered that pressure be put on the witnesses to change their stories if it had anything to do with bikers or kerosene or matches. It was Doug Knight who stared into that TV camera and said electrical fault was
mm-hmm.
to blame.
Mm-hmm.
But Doug Knight is the guy on the bottom rung of this ladder. And this ladder has a bunch of rungs in it. You're not going to believe it. His boss was a guy named Bill Allen. He was the next guy up on the ladder. He was years later discovered to be a crooked cop. He was indicted and sent to prison years later.
For something else.
For something else. But now let's get back to Abe Saffron.
Okay, yeah.
Most people looked at Luna Park in the 1970s and saw this amazing, wonderful, safe, happy fun land. But Abe Saffron looked at that property and saw, I should put a hotel there or condominiums. Sydney Harbor Bridge is right there. The Sydney Opera House is right over there. What a view this would be if I could just get rid of Luna Park. Now, that's the best theory. That's the theory that this documentary gives you. It's pretty compelling evidence when you sit down and watch the whole thing. And I'm going to hit the highlights as we wrap this thing up today.
Okay.
So let's describe Abe Saffron. Abe Saffron was a real estate developer. And in certain circles, he was referred to as Mr. Sin.
Mm-hmm.
In Sydney in the 70s. He owned bars in the red light district. He owned strip clubs.
Okay, I get you.
And
that,
as one
that
person...
That wasn't enough?
Yeah.
He didn't have enough bars and strip clubs?
I guess not. As one person in the documentary put it, I believe very much he was trying to sidestep any potential legal complications. He described Abe Saffron as, quote, a very dark figure in the entertainment business in Australia.
Okay. Why get into a hotel or condominiums? I mean, there's got to be a reason other than just money, right? I mean, I know that sounds strange, but okay. All right. Yeah. I was just saying, is there a reason for these condos? Right. Are they going to launder money? Are they going to...
Well, nobody ever says in the documentary, hotels or condominiums. That's me talking.
Okay.
But
okay.
It's this prime piece of real estate.
He wants this real estate.
On Sydney.
For whatever reason. Okay. Okay.
In my imagination, it's got to be for high-rise condos, but maybe it's not.
But because he's not going to put strip joints and bars there. It's not in this area.
Maybe.
Or maybe. I don't know.
I mean, okay. He is Mr. Sin at the time.
Okay.
And so we, in addition to the bars and nightclubs, let's throw in criminal activities like illegal drugs and prostitution mm-hmm. and illegal gambling.
Yeah.
Abe Saffron was a guy who got into trouble a lot, but he always got out of it.
Because of Bill and Doug.
That's right. And some other people.
Okay.
He was the Teflon Don of Sydney in the 1970s. He was the John Gotti
okay.
type guy.
All right.
Ooh, we got to do that story one day, too.
Squirrel.
Pack it away.
Loves a mob. Yeah.
More often than not, the charges filed against Abe Saffron would include something illegal, like I just mentioned, along with some other combination of mob-related activities, political corruption, mm-hmm. bribing police officers,
mm-hmm.
and let's toss in blackmail and extortion for good measure.
Mm. Okay.
And now the story is starting to come together. It has come together now.
Well, it is kind of, but I'm a little confused as to his connection to this mob family.
I think it's only briefly mentioned in the documentary series, so don't make too much of that.
Okay.
I think they just said that to...
There's a parallel, or is he actually connected?
No, they were associates in a way that they sometimes did business together.
Okay.
And if you do business with a mobster,
okay.
that makes you a mobster. That's the insinuation
in
the documentary.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, that's clear now. Right.
So now we've got cover-up, corruption, arson, and murder.
Mm-hmm.
7 weeks after the tragedy, the park... shut down.
Mm-hmm.
There was a problem with the lease that had been ongoing. And all of a sudden, they're going to do this process where they're going to see who's going to get the lease going forward.
But and couldn't, if you're that connected, couldn't you just have a problem with the lease and not have to murder 7 people?
I don't know that they intended to murder anyone.
Okay.
Because they started the fire at closing time.
Well, that's what happens when you get...
Remember, some of the other
ruffians,
rides had already shut down.
That's what happens when you hire that done and you get ruffians to do it who really don't give a crap about
people.
Yeah, but
if you're involved in all these criminal activities, it is ruffians who...
Well, they have to do it. Yeah, you're not going to get good people to do
it. They're your customers at your illegal...
That's true.
...den of sin.
They want to do that. Or maybe they owe you... a debt at your illegal den of sin, and this is how they're going to repay
you
or something. I don't know. That's probably me seeing too many movies, but it's very obvious that there are people still going through the ride when they're doing this.
Yeah.
So I don't think you can say...
Even the ride operator who saw the guys come out of the door, who saw the bikies, he thinks maybe they just went in to make out, or, you know, if there was a guy and a girl, or to take a pee.
No, I'm talking about the ruffians. You can't say that they didn't mean to, or it was a total accident, because they walked in and walked out and the ride is still going.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they're standing there watching it, talking about kerosene and matches. Mm-hmm. They understand that people are going to die.
I agree.
There's no way they don't understand that.
Yeah. I see what you're saying. So when this lease situation came up a few weeks later, to everyone's surprise, except maybe Abe Saffron, it was a company that some of his relatives controlled that got the lease for Luna Park.
Okay. What did they do with it?
Well, they kept it going.
They kept the park going?
For a while, but I think there were long-term plans that they had put into motion that never came to fruition. One thing that Abe Saffron did in the meantime, while the park still was in operation, all of a sudden, all the arcade games got hauled out, and a company that he owned that supplied arcade games replaced them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So he started making money.
Sure.
Immediately.
Lots.
With perhaps other long-term plans on the drawing board.
Okay.
Now, ultimately, he lost control of the park years later, and it's still there today. I don't know.
Oh.
I didn't get into that. Mm. But the park is still there. There's still a Luna Park there today, and it's one of the only two amusement parks in the world that is protected by state law. That will always be an amusement park at Luna Park, and it was because of all of the shit that hit the fan after this happened.
So,
and all these nefarious efforts to take it over and turn it into something else. They passed a law and said, that's always going to be an amusement park.
So does Australia, does the country own this, or the city of Sydney?
It's the state. The state of New South Wales
owns this property.
Owns
I guess the country does, mm-hmm. but I think the state controls.
But the state controls it.
What happens?
So it
to
would
it.
Seem that Abe may not have wanted to change this. He just wanted to put his stuff in and put his dirty little finger.
Maybe so.
In this. You know,
and he needed a good reason for the lease to not be renewed by the company, given back to the company that at that time controlled it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, maybe all he wanted to do was put in the 100 arcade games.
And but then use it for whatever other money laundering
Then he runs his money through it.
That's his laundry. Going. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that would make sense. But then apparently does he get in trouble or just lose control of it?
I think he eventually died.
Oh, well.
And then somebody else got it.
Because I could see it being a good money laundering place. Mm-hmm. I mean,
absolutely.
How do you prove how much money those arcade games make?
There's no way. I mean, it's perfect.
Yeah, it's perfect.
Yeah.
Did I mention that Abe Saffron had about six other businesses of his burned down under mysterious circumstances in just a year or so?
Mm-mm.
Kerosene and matches.
Same bikies, I guess, that did that.
Same MO.
The ruffians.
If he wanted to get rid of one of the tenants at one of his bars that he had leased out, set it on fire. If he wanted to cash in an overvalued insurance policy, kaboom. Mm. That's what Abe Saffron did. That's
did
how he
operated.
Did
he have some sort of
he was Mr.
pyro
Sin.
Nickname other than Mr. Sin?
Yeah.
Mr. Sin. So you think you would get in trouble, right? But if you have the state mm-hmm. police, and this is the state police.
Mm-hmm. This is Bill and Doug.
This is the equivalent of the Alabama Law Enforcement Agency.
If you have the Bill and Doug Incorporated helping you
in
out.
In your back pocket.
Cleaning it up. Way to go, Bill and Doug. Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Yeah. And that worked for a long time for Abe Saffron. Mm. That setup. One former New South Wales state prosecutor who agreed to be interviewed in the documentary for the very first time but refused to appear on screen
mm-hmm.
for fear of reprisal described Abe Saffron as, quote, the one who got away with the ghost train fire.
Ah. But as with a lot of things, death eventually got him.
Yeah. I don't think the prosecutor, when he said that, meant just the ghost train fire because Abe Saffron got away with a lot of
sounds like
activity.
A lot of fires he got away with. And, you know.
I mean, this guy still doesn't want to expose himself 40 years later.
Yeah.
So he.
Fear of family.
Yes.
Yeah.
Fear of other.
There's definitely someone there still that
in
he's
fact,
afraid of.
That prosecutor said in the documentary that he believes that the conspiracy
mm-hmm.
went all the way up to the governor's office.
Mm-hmm.
They call him, it's the premier the premier of New South Wales, but it's the equivalent of
the governor of New South Wales.
There are six states in Australia. New South Wales is one of them.
And we can certainly relate to that. We have discussed cases here where things go all the way to the governor's office.
Looking at you, Arkansas.
Looking hard at you, Arkansas. Hard, from Arkansas. Different, many different cases. Yeah.
So anyway, the State Licensing Commission issued a report after the leases were signed, when they changed hands after the fire, that accused Abe Saffron of having ties to the new lessees. And we know now that some of his relatives controlled this company. But that investigation got whitewashed and buried at the time.
But that's also what you do if you're trying to cover up things. Then you just, you take something and you put it in a family member's name.
Yeah.
And then
this was in this
it's
investigation
clean that way. You've washed it.
Exactly.
You've laundered
this,
everything.
There was such an uproar over all of this that that investigation took place in 1986. So 6 years after the fire, this investigation happened. But the documentary will pretty much explain to you that it was a whitewash.
They buried
the whole damn thing again, just to shut everybody up.
Mm-hmm.
When this documentary came out in 2021, the uproar occurred again.
And that's what documentaries are designed to
do. This is, you've got to watch this documentary. It's so good. So the state of New South Wales in 2021 issued a $1 million reward for any information that could help explain what happened at the Ghost Train fire.
How many dollar?
$1 million.
And it's not been claimed
to this day.
What do they use? They don't use US dollar. What do they use?
I guess they
do they use pounds?
Would they use the euro? No, England went back to the, they got off the euros, so maybe.
England is on pounds.
Yeah, they went back to pounds. They dropped the euro and went back to pounds.
Because Ireland's, well, part, most of Ireland is on the euro.
Okay.
It's just the Australian dollar.
The Australian dollar.
Okay,
yeah.
Their own dollar.
Yeah.
Got it. And I don't know why we're associating them with Britain. They're not, they're their own thing. That was just my ignorance and
equating them to England.
They're
an independent nation now, but there's, it's kind of like Canada. Canada's an independent nation, but they're still associated with Great Britain in the sense that that is their king.
I gotcha. Oh, but Australia's not that anymore.
I thought they were.
Oh.
I think so. You know, I should have looked into that.
I don't know.
Katie is furiously typing right now.
Yeah, I don't know enough to say.
It was a self-governing dominion in the British Empire back in 1901 when they came together to create the Commonwealth of Australia.
Okay.
So at some point it was.
But present day, it's Australia.
It's the independent sovereign nation of Australia.
Yeah.
They do recognize the monarch.
They do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, same as Canada.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Is that kind of like
founding member of the modern Commonwealth? There's some connection there.
Okay.
But it
kind
is
of,
an independent
kind
nation.
Of like South Africa. Is it?
Yeah.
Kind of tied to Great Britain.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of.
Yeah.
Still. Okay.
You know, there was a time when the sun never set on the British Empire. They controlled half the planet.
Turks and Caicos, you get the airport there and they have a picture. Well, it was the queen when I was there and I guess now it'd be King Charles.
King Charles now.
I recently, and everybody knows this already, but you know, Puerto Rico is basically part of the United States.
It's a protectorate, I think is officially what it's called. But yeah, at least the good thing is you don't have to have your passport to go to
And the U.S. Puerto dollar Rico. Yeah. is the currency.
That's the case in a lot of the Caribbean.
They say when you look it up that they're, that English is their language, but I would argue, I think it's Spanish.
Right.
I mean, they speak English too, but there's a lot of Spanish speaking.
That makes sense.
Yeah, definitely.
All right, so guys, that's kind of almost the end of the story. There's one little tidbit that I will share with you in closing. Tony Carroll, the father of one of the 13-year-old boys who died from Waverly College, in 2007 told the Sydney Morning Herald newspaper that while still missing his son terribly, quote, "We believe that carrying anger and hate against anyone responsible for his death will only end up being destructive to the rest of our family. While we do not believe Mr. Saffron was a good man, we bear him no ill will." So he's a better man than I am.
Wow.
So
Is that statement made out of fear? Or is that statement just because I'm just an incredible human being?
I think it's made out of the fact that he's an incredible human being.
And he's got to let that go. Okay. Yeah. When did Abe Saffron die?
Not sure.
Good Lord.
88, I want to say.
Okay.
I think so that's right. I didn't write it down, but I think I remember reading that. Somebody will tell me if I'm wrong. Katie is looking it up right now. While she looks it up, I will tell you that you should go and check out our Facebook page because we update it every week. We'll give you the link to the story or to the latest podcast, and we comment, and you can comment and give us a shout out if you would like to, and we will give you one on a future episode of True Crime on East Street. Katie, what'd you find?
2006.
Abe Saffron passed
away.
Good
Lord.
He was 86.
86 years old.
All right.
So say something nice about us on your podcast platform of choice. Leave us a 5-star review. Is that it, guys?
That's it.
Good night, everybody.
Johnny.